From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, it's down at the bottom of the ballot, easily overlooked, yet affecting so many homes in Michigan, the race for Board of Education.
Voters are going to encounter a really big change at the ballot box in Michigan this year. That's the end of straight ticket voting. And we don't know how that's going to impact this race, but there's reason to think that it will be pretty significant.
GM announces healthy third quarter results and then offers early retirement to 18,000 white-collar workers.
To coin a cliche, this is not your grandfather's General Motors anymore.
And we look at CBD oil.
There's so many other people that don't want to get high, but they have all these health issues that could be solved through a CBD type of a product.
And we have a head start on Veterans Day with two men who fought in Europe in World War II. Those stories today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The midterm elections are 5 days away, and the races for governor, attorney general, secretary of state, the state house and senate, and of course Congress have sucked up most of the political oxygen. And that has left an important race standing in the shadows, the race for two open seats on the Michigan Board of Education. Let's talk about that now as we welcome Kobe Levin of Chalkbeat Detroit with us via Skype. Kobe, the headline of your story in Chalkbeat, I thought, summed it up beautifully, a guide to the critical election race you've never heard of.
Yes. Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me. So I just took a look at my sample ballot, and it's right near the bottom. Yet these candidates are going to play a major role in the coming year in issues like school closures, which will affect thousands of families across the state. They'll make decisions on learning standards that have been hugely controversial over the last year. And they'll also have a big voice in conversations about school funding, which, of course, affect every student in Michigan.
So many, many households are going to be impacted by a race that's at the bottom of the ballot, and I dare say most of us don't know who the candidates are. So before we talk about who the candidates are, let's talk about, first of all, job one for the school board after the election is filling that gap at the head, because since the death of Superintendent Brian Whiston last spring, we haven't had anybody as school superintendent.
Right. So we have an interim superintendent now, but it seems clear, and if you ask any of the candidates, they'll tell you that the most important thing that they will do is pick a new state superintendent. This is the top education official in the state of Michigan. And it's actually that person who will make big decisions about whether, for instance, to close the lowest performing schools in the state. According to a timeline put out by the department, they should have a decision by next July, and it's a big one for families in Michigan.
Very, very big. So let's dive into some more details of these issues facing the state school board. So one of them is, as you alluded to, this what to do with struggling schools and an A through F grading system?
Right. So A through F grading system is something that mostly Republican legislators are talking about. In fact, there already is a rating system for schools that the state puts together. But if that were to happen, if an A through F grading system were to come through, they would make decisions about, for instance, what does student growth mean? How do you define chronic absenteeism? And those are measures that would ultimately be used to judge schools and potentially close them.
Also, social studies standards. We should dive into this a little bit, because we're seeing attempts by conservative lawmakers to change the things that some of the things that are being studied in school in social studies. Tell us about that.
Right. So there's been a hullabaloo over the last handful of months over an article put out by our. It started with an article put out by our colleagues at Bridge Magazine that pointed out that a handful of Republican lawmakers had sought to remove some references to the NAACP, to gay rights, to climate change. This was viewed as sort of a political move, and it prompted a big outcry. The state held off on the standards, and there have been a handful of listening sessions since then. By all accounts, people are pretty upset about the attempt to change the learning standards. Now, the State Board of Education, which is on the ballot on Tuesday, they make the ultimate decision there. They set state learning standards, which are sort of a guide for school districts across the state. So they'll be able to ultimately put this controversy to rest one way or another.
Am I correct remembering that one of the things on that list was to remove the word democratic from the phrase core democratic values?
I may be right, yeah.
And another big issue is the so-called read or flunk law. So how will the people elected Tuesday for the State Board of Education be involved in the read or flunk law?
So the state still does not know what it means to read on grade level. That's because the test that measures third grade reading is not designed to say this third grader is on a third grade level. It doesn't have a standard for that. So they're working right now to set those. And the new state superintendent, who will be picked by the board, of course, will play a large role in deciding what exactly it means. And if they, for instance, set the level fairly low, that is, if they say that a third grade reader is only doing, doing fewer things than they might otherwise, that could change the number of third graders who are held back under the read or flunk law. So again, it's a pretty technical decision. I think these issues are pretty obscure for most folks in Michigan, but the impact on people's lives, again, are just huge.
So we have, as I see in your story, 11 candidates vying for two open seats with eight-year terms, and you focus on the two Democrats and the two Republicans on the ballot. Tell us a little about them, especially where they stand on whether or not they would want to close struggling schools.
Yep, so it's split neatly by party. You've got Tiffany Tilley and Judy Pritchett on the Democratic side who will say, nope, struggling schools should not be closed. So on the other side of the ballot, Tammy Carlone and Richard Ziley, the incumbent, have both said that at least in some cases they would close the most struggling schools in Michigan, and it bears mentioning that most of those are in Detroit.
What are their views? Can you break down their views on testing?
On testing, yes. So Tammy Carlone stands out as someone who's very concerned about the amount of testing that students are dealing with in schools. This is tied up with her advocacy as a parent against the Common Core learning standards. There was a big political fight over that roughly a decade ago. She was heavily involved, and part of the concern they would say was that Common Core would lead to more testing. Judy Pritchett, just for instance, on the Democratic side, is a former administrator. She was a chief academic officer at the Macomb County ISD, the intermediate school district. So she is an education expert, and I think she's well aware both of the requirements that come from the state and the federal government for testing, and of, I think she would say, that the value of testing for measuring how students are learning and whether they're learning.
Thinking of what's ahead for the state school board after Election Day and these two new members take the seats, and it's supposed to be a long enough term to protect people on the board from political pressures. But as you point out in your piece, you know, you're looking at something at the bottom of the ballot where chances are people don't know the names and may just either not vote or just fill in a couple of names and be done with it.
Voters are going to encounter a really big change at the ballot box in Michigan this year. That's the end of straight ticket voting. And we don't know how that's going to impact this race, but there's reason to think that it will be pretty significant. Historically, this race, because it's relatively obscure, has gone in the direction of the overall election. So if the Democrats have a good year, the Democratic candidates for state school board get elected, and vice versa. I think it's reasonable to think that maybe folks won't recognize the names here or even won't understand what the State Board of Education is and just won't vote. So that's one concern. You know, but I think probably the overall trend, which is that whichever party does better, their candidates are swept in, will hold true.
Well, you can certainly go to chalkbeat.org and look up Kobe Levin's piece, The Guide to the Critical Education Race You've Never Heard Of, and read what he has reported on the candidates and certainly League of Women Voters guides. There are resources out there to do some homework before next Tuesday. Kobe Levin, Chalkbeat Detroit, always good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
In keeping with the theme of education, today's Voter Voices segment touches on the challenges facing young people today.
Hello, my name is Kenny Rogers. I live in Traverse City. I'm 33 and am a veterinarian. I am concerned that politicians just don't seem to be all that interested in the effects of the student debt crisis. We're about almost $2 trillion, and that affects primarily young Americans like myself. I do fear that it could easily be the next bubble that the subprime mortgages were back in 2008. Unfortunately, about a quarter of loan holders are facing either default or delinquency status. My fear is that these are just going to continue to reduce young Americans' ability to access capital, for them to be able to buy homes and cars, to start a business or have a family, and to invest or save for their future. My fear about the political climate is that it does seem to be just overtly partisan. The concept of a good idea just doesn't exist anymore. That two people just can't agree for the sake of a good idea. It has to be polarized.
My name is Hazel Gomez. I live in Detroit, Michigan, and I am the lead community organizer with Dream of Detroit. As a mother of two young children, the quality of the Detroit public school system has really left me speechless. Unfortunately, my children are not able to attend DPS schools because of the quality of education, because of the high turnover rate of teachers, even the conditions of the school. That means crumbling walls, that means holes in the floor, that means not being able to flush the toilet, not even be able to drink water because of the lead. So how are they supposed to function in a crumbling education system? And so if we really want to build this city and do better for all of us, people who've been here for generations, then we really need to invest in our children because they deserve it. If not, we're just failing them. With everything going on from the Muslim ban to overall, the xenophobic policies, things that are happening at the border right now, passports being taken away from American citizens who are of Latino, Hispanic descent, ICE coming into houses and taking away their passports. How terrifying is it to be an American citizen and to know that a federal agency can come into my home, remove my passport, and say, I am not an American citizen? So it's really terrifying to think that.
Special thanks to Kayla Fond and Razi Jaffrey for recording these interviews. Coming up, what's the future of hemp and CBD oil in Michigan?
There's so many other people that don't want to get high, but they have all these health issues that could be solved through a CBD type of a product.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. General Motors is offering buyouts to 18,000 salaried employees in North America. That news came as the automaker announced healthy third-quarter profits. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. So, Daniel, the last time GM offered buyouts to its salaried employees was 2009, mired in bankruptcy. So why are these being offered at the very time GM's announcing very healthy earnings and a more than 10% profit margin for the third quarter?
To coin a cliche, this is not your grandfather's General Motors anymore. You know, I think that earnings statement and that announcement yesterday really was two parts. Number one, yes, we can perform in adverse conditions. And two, we're serious. Really what's happening here is the company is in a transition. They're going to be cutting these jobs even as they're going to be hiring other kinds of jobs.
Yeah, the GM Cruise hiring is what, going up something like $500 million in the fourth quarter?
Right. That's spending, yeah. But they are going to be spending more to hire, to build capability. So I think what you're seeing here is a company that is saying, our core base business, trucks, SUVs, and cars, is operating at a very high level. When you are at 10%+ margins, the car business in North America as a Detroit-based car company, you are really performing well. And GM did that this quarter. FCA did that this quarter. Ford's a little bit behind that, which is part of the challenges that Ford faces at this point. But there's no question that GM is, I think, a company that is on the move, and management is making these moves while they can. Historically, we would see these kinds of buyout offers and threatened layoffs when things aren't going well.
Like in 2009.
Like in 2009, that's exactly right. When there were plant closings and there were buyouts and there were layoffs and they eliminated 4 of 8 U.S. brands. You know, I mean, a lot of really draconian things that took place, and I think people have kind of forgotten some of that. But we are moving into a period here where I think you're going to see more of this. You're definitely going to see more of it at Ford. They've telegraphed that, finally have acknowledged that some of that's likely to come in the United States. But what's interesting is how quickly GM is moving here. Ford is in the midst of this restructuring that it seems to be moving in slow motion by comparison. General Motors has moved with, I think, a lot of dispatch and a lot of focus on restructuring their core business to free up capital to invest in technology for what we call Auto 2.0.
So what we're seeing really, this is like the front line of GM's transformation from that 20th century, your father's car maker, to the 21st, what you call Auto 2.0, looking at autonomous vehicles, looking at transportation.
That's exactly right. And they're also, as part of that, when I started covering General Motors in the mid-90s, they were everywhere in the world. They were in Russia. They were the first in China. They were the first to go in behind the former Iron Curtain. They did all that kind of stuff. They've now exited a lot of that. They've left Russia. They sold Europe that they were in for 90 years. They just exited the entire continent entirely, with the exception of selling the odd Corvette to a rich Swiss guy. You know, they've walked away because they're saying, if we're not going to make money here, and there are going to be all sorts of demands, regulatory and others, for us to invest in new engine technologies and other kinds of things, we're not going to do it. And it's more important for us to deliver profitability. And that's what I think you're seeing here. The bias of General Motors right now is for profitability, number one, and investment in new technology to position themselves to be a leader in Auto 2.0.
And last week, you and I talked about the fact that Ford turned in strong third quarter earnings and Wall Street went meh. So how did Wall Street react to GM's buyout news and the third quarter report?
That's a great question. And the short answer is up more than 9% on the day. I mean, that I think tells you, but I think it was the combination. It was the numbers, but also they're telegraphing where they're going and how serious they are about right-sizing and tweaking how the company, you know, the talent within the company. Do we have the right talent in the right areas for the right jobs going forward? And I think what they were saying in that announcement was the answer is no, but we're going to do something about it.
And if you're a salaried worker at Fiat Chrysler and Ford, would you be bracing for buyout offers?
Ford, definitely, because I think they basically already said that.
Mm-hmm.
Fiat Chrysler, probably. I don't see that they're going to be able to go through this whole process and avoid this. Now, they're not in the pack in the same place where General Motors is in the Auto 2.0 pack. GM's, I think, ahead of Fiat Chrysler. They're pursuing a bit of a different strategy. But I think there's going to be pressure on the companies going forward. And a lot of it's internal pressure. It's not necessarily going to come from the street. There's going to be pressure to really tweak their talent models and have talent in the right places. FCA is a different kind of company. It's got a different kind of international footprint. So I think it'll be different going forward.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
On Tuesday, Michigan voters will decide whether recreational marijuana should be legal in our state. If Proposal 1 passes, it'll be a boon for the marijuana industry, no doubt. But what about hemp and its chief medicinal component, CBD? Our next guest predicts that in 5 years, the CBD oil industry will have exploded, and those three letters, instead of needing explanation, will be a household name. But we're not there yet. I recently spoke with Brady Madden, director of e-commerce for MHR Brands. Its largest retail website is made by hemp. And I asked him what CBD stands for.
CBD stands for cannabidiol. Some people pronounce it cannabidiol. I mean, there's a few different variations of it.
Easier to say CBD, isn't it?
Exactly. CBD is better to say.
And what is it exactly?
Essentially, CBD is where the therapeutic effects or where the medicinal benefits come from the cannabis plant. And essentially, it's a cannabinoid, which is very similar. Another well-known cannabinoid is THC. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, we'll say, the second most well-known cannabinoid.
All right, so tell us how it works and particularly how it's different from marijuana.
The first thing I always like to talk about really is that there is a difference between hemp and marijuana. I think that that really, as a website and as a company, is the number one thing that we educate people on, is that there's a difference. Hemp and marijuana have distinctive qualities. Although they both are considered cannabis plants, marijuana is very high in its THC content, very low in its CBD content, whereas hemp is high in CBD content, very low in marijuana content, obviously.
And for those who are a little unfamiliar with weed culture, the THC is what?
THC is the psychoactive, or we call it the intoxicating.
What gets you high?
Exactly.
Okay. But the CBD component works how?
The CBD component, as a cannabinoid, it actually mimics natural cannabinoids that we can have in our bodies. Anandamide is actually the most common. And essentially, it's mimicking this anandamide, and it's interacting with our body's endocannabinoid systems. And when it interacts with our endocannabinoid systems, that's where it can help us with, you know, nervous system issues or health-specific like pain issues and things like that, or inflammation and a number of other reasons.
So how do you take CBD oil?
CBD can be taken a number of ways. That's actually a very good question. And partially, it kind of depends on the person, you know, kind of depends on the lifestyle. I'd say the most common forms typically, especially for a new user, are going to be something like a concentrate, which is typically in like a plastic syringe where they'll just be dispensing a little bit of like a paste underneath their tongue. Also very common from that as a tincture. Again, it's more of like an oil type of a base, but placed under the tongue. So it's sublingual, and all the capillaries under our tongue are able to help absorb it more into our bodies. Vape is also very common as well.
Okay. Now, what are some of the major health problems or health conditions or issues that people might turn to CBD for relief?
You know, there are a number of conditions. That's kind of, I don't want to say endless, but I mean, it's essentially the idea with CBD, or really the overall effect of it, is it's helping return our bodies to homeostasis. Homeostasis essentially being a sense of balance. And we can always get off, you know, too far to the left, too far to the right, or however we want to call it. For instance, with myself, I have ulcerative colitis. And so that's meaning a lot of inflammation in my GI system and those type of things. It's been incredibly beneficial for me. I mean, obviously, I have to watch my diet and do different things like that, but the benefits of helping remove the inflammation and that are just incredible. So when you talk about inflammation, you can talk about ulcerative colitis. You can talk about colitis, bursitis, arthritis. Anything ending in itis is going to mean that there's an inflammation in there. People that have issues with pain. So maybe it's from a back surgery, or maybe it's just from too many years of sports or something like that, injuring their ankles and knees and joint pain and things like that.
So you put it under your tongue, the CBD works with your body to do exactly what? Help us understand what it does.
So what it's doing is in we referred to a little bit earlier, it's activating our endocannabinoid system. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, it's really binding to pain receptors or receptors within our bodies that as it's returning us to that middle ground or that homeostasis. Mm-hmm. So maybe our health problem is that we have issues with pain or something like that, whatever it's from. Mm-hmm. When it interacts with that, it's activating that endocannabinoid system, which is helping restore that sense of balance.
And because it is low in THC, it doesn't get people feeling high?
That's correct, yes. Okay. Yep. The feeling are more typically more of a relaxed type of a feeling. It can be used throughout the day. Mm-hmm. However, if somebody's maybe using it to maybe help them sleep better, obviously they might want to shoot for that serving to be a little ways before bed.
Now let's talk about hemp farming and restrictions that exist in Michigan around CBD oil. First of all, hemp farming, how is it regulated in our state?
Right now, there's a program. Actually, it's a federal program, but it's a federal program that would allow universities to be able to grow hemp for the sake of research, studying, and everything that they can do around that. Everything that we've seen in the state of Michigan is that most universities don't want to get involved with that because they're afraid of losing federal funding.
What are the restrictions that the state, LARA, particularly the licensing arm, has put around CBD oil in Michigan?
So LARA has recently updated their understanding of that. And I think that in our state, that's really been a big confusion for a lot of people, whether that be on the consumer side of things or whether that be on even the business side of things. Okay. So we as a company, or even CBD companies in general, we don't operate under a medical marijuana program. We operate under the 2014 Farm Bill, which differentiates hemp and marijuana as marijuana containing above 0.3% THC and hemp being products of the cannabis sativa plant that are below 0.3% THC. Okay. Companies will have different things. We call them a certificate of analysis that can be able to prove that.
What do we have right now in terms of regulation?
Yes. So LARA recently updated their understanding of it and saying that CBD oil manufacturers, groups, and whoever should be operating under the medical marijuana program in the state of Michigan.
Because it hasn't been.
Correct, because it hasn't been. So it was more them updating their understanding. However, there has not been a law that's changed. Like, their understanding updating is not something being legislated at the state level and actually making CBD illegal to sell.
So we have medical marijuana legalized. But no focus legislatively on CBD oil. And here it is helping people, as you say, with pain or anxiety with no hallucinogenic effect. Why is that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's just the stigma that goes with the cannabis plant in general. Hemp specifically has really been lumped under the understanding of marijuana for so long that, I mean, that's why that's the biggest thing that we educate on. There's a difference between hemp and marijuana. So because they've been lumped together for so long, that's how people look at it.
Now, you mentioned the 2018 Farm Bill that's coming up. How would hemp and CBD be affected by the 2018 Farm Bill?
So in the 2018 Farm Bill, there's a legislature in there that would allow for hemp to be grown on a national level in terms of like as an agricultural product, which would therefore also make CBD products and variations of it legal on the national level as well.
So that's a big step.
Correct. Huge step.
They're similar products, but is there tension, is there friction between folks in the CBD oil industry and in the marijuana business?
That's a good question. You know, I wouldn't really say that there's friction between them. I would say that there's an understanding on the marijuana side of things, which has some truth to it, that people just want to get high. And there certainly is that truth. But I think what they're really missing out on, or really missing with that type of a statement, is that there's so many other people that don't want to get high, but they have all these health issues that could be solved through a CBD type of a product. And so I wouldn't say that there's tension or friction, but I would say that there are times that people on the THC side will, you know, oh, you're a CBD company. Oh, that's cute. You know, okay. It's more or less looked at as like, okay, cool.
Back to consumers. So we know that people, because of the change in law in Michigan, and we have legalized medical marijuana, can get a card and obtain marijuana for medical purposes. Of course, things could open up depending on the outcome of the vote in November as far as legalizing recreational marijuana. I want to be real clear. What's the option if someone wants to get CBD oil?
Currently?
Mm-hmm.
If somebody wants to get CBD oil currently, they can purchase it online and ship it directly to them.
Is that legal?
That is legal.
All
yep.
Right.
Under the 2014 Farm Bill. Okay. To my understanding from our conversation with Laura is that CBD businesses in Michigan are not allowed to sell directly to dispensaries. So our products aren't being sold in a dispensary unless we classify ourselves, fill out our paperwork, and put ourselves under the medical marijuana program. But they also told us that we can sell our CBD products to anybody that's outside of that. So meaning if you're a spa or a salon or a retail store, we have gas stations that are looking to carry CBD products now. And there's a number of other businesses that are in that realm. Veterinary clinics have been doing this. I've seen chiropractor offices have it in there. So supposedly we're able to sell to them in Michigan, but we're not able to sell to the dispensary specifically unless we're licensed under the medical marijuana program.
All right. Thinking of having CBD oil products available at a gas station, can you take too much CBD oil and what would be the consequences?
There really haven't been any massive reportings on like a CBD overdose or an issue with that. And really cannabis in general, there's really no such thing as overdosing with a cannabis product. Typically the person would just get tired and go to sleep. However, that being said, if we're talking about, let's say, a tincture product that maybe has more oil base in there, we'll use like a hemp seed oil and a grape seed oil or something to thin it so that it's a little bit more fat based, so then the person can more readily absorb their CBD. But if somebody has too much oil, whether it's a CBD product or whether it's even olive oil, they're probably going to get a stomach ache. If somebody was trying maybe like an edible product, like a gummy or something like that, and had, let's call it north of 30 milligrams, there's a chance that they might get a little sleepy after taking something like that. But really, that's going to be the worst that's happened. I've personally noticed the worst thing that's happened, and I like to experiment. Mm-hmm. So I like to try many different forms of CBD products, obviously being in my job and wanting to understand this, but also wanting to get healthy from my colitis.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I'd say the worst that's really ever happened to me of consuming too much CBD in a single day because we're taste testing or we're, mm-hmm. you know, doing something like that is maybe I would get a little bit dizzy. But, you know, if I went through the medications that I've been on for colitis and for other health issues, I think I'd much rather take a little bit of dizziness if I take too much.
Where do you think the CBD industry will be in Michigan, let's say in 5 or 10 years?
I really think it's going to be a massive industry. I think it's going to be its own industry that stands on its own two legs outside of medical marijuana products, outside of THC products. There are a number of people that are going to look at a CBD product or even just hemp in general a lot differently because this vote that we have coming up in November, I really believe that most people in Michigan, or a lot of people in Michigan, are going to want access to these types of products. And so obviously we have a lot of work to do in terms of creating laws and, you know, who can have them, who cannot have them, where can we have them, where can we not have them. And we'll work through that. But I think CBD as a product is going to be something that we're going to see on shelves everywhere. I think it's going to be a household name type of a product, whether that be a brand or just CBD in general.
Because if that vote is yes in November, it all comes in?
It does. And there is specific hemp language in that bill ballot in November that will actually legalize hemp also as an agricultural product. And when we get into that, I mean, the opportunities are endless of where people can go.
Brady Madden giving us a look ahead at CBD oil and hemp. He's director of e-commerce for MHR Brands. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up, we talk with two World War II veterans, and we hear what they've learned about bridging partisan divides.
You have no choice of who serves with you. You have to take these men and figure out what the strengths are of each guy, because your life depends on him, and his life can depend on you.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Veterans Day is close at hand, so we're taking this opportunity to sit down with a couple of America's longest-living veterans, men who fought in World War II. Guy Stern is 96. As a teenager, he got out of Nazi Germany, came to America, and then he wound up serving in the U.S. Army as World War II broke out, where he rose to the rank of Master Sergeant. He landed in Normandy around the time of D-Day as part of a group called the Ritchie Boys. It was a special military intelligence unit made up of Germans, Austrians, and Czechs who had fled Nazi Germany, most of them Jewish. His assignment, interrogate German prisoners. And yes, he did lose his family during the war. Eventually, he came to Wayne State University, where he was a distinguished professor of German literature and cultural history, and he served as provost. He's still active at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Oakland County. Guy Stern, welcome back to Stateside.
Good to see you. Thank you for your welcome.
It's so good to have you here. And we are so happy to welcome Art Holst, also 96. He, too, served in the U.S. Army. He rolled into Germany with General George Patton's Third Army. Art rose to the rank of captain, so Guy had to salute Art today as we came in. A couple of notable moments, a German officer surrendered himself and his 600 men to Art. And Art offered one German prisoner the chance to serve out the war as his interpreter or be put in a POW camp. The German chose translator. And in the 1980s, Art visited Germany and had a reunion with his former prisoner. After the war, Art went on to become a referee in the NFL, and he officiated in Super Bowls 6 and 12. Art Holst, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cindy. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. So,
a pleasure to be with Guy.
Yes, I know you've crossed.
I may have had more rank, but he's 3 months my senior in age. He's smarter.
So here we are, coming up on another Veterans Day. Both of you, well into your 90s, you stop and you realize that World War II ended more than 73 years ago. In all those years since the war, what moment comes to mind that you still remember like it was yesterday? Guy, I'll have you start.
Yes, there are many memorable moments. And there are sometimes moments where the war seems to stand still. And that came right after the invasion. I was ordered to go ashore on D+3. And about a month later, we were still in Normandy because our advance had slowed down. Our tanks were stopped. We were stopped. And then a curious thing happened. Our captain said, all Jewish personnel come to the command tent at 1800 hours. We have gotten some bad news. One of our MPs just got the notice that his wife died in childbirth in Brooklyn. And so the chaplain is coming down here to have the Jewish commemoration and the Jewish prayers for the dead. And so we assembled. In 1 month, you become a fairly hardened soldier. So we all assembled there, and the chaplain invoked the prayers for the dead and for the living. And the war, for one moment, stood absolutely still. And I felt, here we are assembled, and we are crying over a woman we had never seen, over the wife of an MP who we slightly knew, and we were praying. And that is a moment which became unforgettable in the horrors of war.
That is special, and that I think most of us would not have expected you to say that, and what a beautiful moment that was. Art, what's your moment that seems like it just happened?
Well, there are many, many, Cindy, but one that came to my mind first, so I've got to tell you this. How did the war end for me? Well, we were in southern Germany. I finished the war just 1 mile from the Austrian border. And we were staying in a railroad car. The Third Army didn't dig foxholes. General Patton said, they dig foxholes, we attack. So we were staying in a boxcar on May the 8th, 1945. And it came out at a B-17 came over, but instead of being at 17,000 feet, he wasn't at 10,000, he wasn't at 5,000, he was about 2,000 feet. And immediately, I thought, this guy's been shot up, and I hope he's dropped his bomb load. And I looked up, and sure enough, the bomb bay doors came open, and out came what I thought were bombs. They exploded in the air, and out came thousands of leaflets. And there was a little German boy, about 8 years old, standing there, and he was begging me for chocolate. Or kaugummi, that's chocolate or chewing gum. I said, gehen Sie ganz schnell und bringen Sie mir ein Papier für Schokolade. In my poor, poor German, I knew a few words. And he took off and ran and brought it back. I looked at it and it said, the war is over at 11 a.m. or 9 a.m., no more shooting. It's the end of the war. I was thrilled, of course, but I had men out there. And you have no idea what happens at the end of the war. It's celebrations in New York and all that stuff. 350,000 plus Germans surrendered on the same day.
Wow.
And you're responsible for their medical care, their hospital care, their food, their housing, everything. It was a mess. But that sticks out in my mind because as I looked up into that nice blue sky and saw this bomber, I thought those poor guys are going to get it. And it was entirely different. It was how I knew that that was, as we called it, VE Day.
And when that bomber's door went open and those leaflets, Art, started tumbling out. These leaflets, in a supplemental way, part of our responsibility as intelligence personnel. So we were asked to test the effectiveness of these leaflets by criticizing them. One leaflet I have as a model of good psychology in my mind. One of my comrades had suggested it. It was a pass for a prisoner to show to an American soldier, which showed that this was a leaflet guaranteeing decent food, decent quarters, decent treatment. And the most brilliant idea was to have it signed by Dwight D. Eisenhower. And this played very intelligently to the psychology of the Germans. If they saw a document like that, that is a leaflet they dared to keep in their pockets. And those, I think, Art, were the ones you were talking about.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And whoever designed that deserved commendation for it, because regaining the trust of the Germans was a challenge.
What about a person? What about one person that maybe you served with or you met during your time fighting in Europe that you just can't seem to forget?
I would think the person that sticks out for me was our commanding captain, Captain Kahn, who came also from Germany and was in charge of our whole intelligence operation. And he was such an understanding and excellent leader that we've almost forgot that we had one before him who was equally excellent and a completely different personality. His name was Captain Rust, and he came from Texas. And the most memorable moment with Captain Rust was when he called me over and he said, Sergeant Stern, this is an interrogation for you. You are the only one who has as a skill Spanish as well as German and French. So I have here three Spaniards who took part in the Spanish Civil War, escaped to France, were simply overtaken again by the Germans, and were sent to the Channel Islands to install the fortifications if we ever took a chance of liberating these islands from the German occupation. So I told them in halting Spanish, I must admit, that I was to interrogate them about the fortifications of these islands. I never had military Spanish, and they said, just give us some writing materials and we'll take over. And they did beautiful maps of all the fortification from a machine gun nest to an artillery position. I brought that in, and Captain Rust looked at me and he said, Sergeant Stern, that is a heck of a good interrogation.
You did well.
And I said, thank you, sir.
What about you, Art? Who's the person you can't
Two people.
All right.
Basic training. Sparta, Wisconsin. Our second lieutenant. He was overweight, was not in shape, and he would yell at us and scream at us. You do something wrong. He said, get down there and duck waddle. And he'd make us waddle like a duck till we were ready to drop over some minor thing. And I came away from that thinking, if I ever get to be an officer, I am not going to be like him. I've always said that everybody has value. If nothing else, you can serve as a bad example. And he did. And so in my training days, I used that. If I had a man, I said, give me 50 push-ups. But I got down and did 50 with him and then did more. And I learned that from that one experience.
That one bad officer.
The second man that sticks out of my mind is Sergeant Karl Steinmesser of the German Wehrmacht. He was the man I had captured. I won't go into that, but made him my interpreter. And we were together for 5 months. I got him out of the Army in July. In July, I said, Carl, you got to go out. I'm taking the prison camp. Oh, no, Lieutenant. I said, yep, tomorrow morning. And we had a prison camp at the airport in Bad Aibling, Germany, and about 50,000 prisoners on it. Walked in there, and the major said, I said, I've got a prisoner of war. He said, where has he been? I said, I kept his interpreter. He said, I never heard of such a thing. I said, neither did I, but I did it. I said, I'd like to have him out as quick as possible. And he said, how soon? I said, noon. He threw his pen down his desk. He said, we've been in a blankety-blank war, Lieutenant. I said, I know I've been in it. But I said, he understands the railroad, and he speaks English. It's a big help to me. And he got me out at 1 o'clock. So I said, Carl, you're free to leave. He said, I'll stick with you, Lieutenant. Stick with me for those months. And then in 1985, I went to Europe, as you mentioned, and met him again with his wife, talked about, reflected on the war. Those two events probably stick out more to me. The rest of it was just kind of a maelstrom, and seeing Dachau, which you mentioned.
You saw Dachau, yes. If you just joined us, we are talking with two World War II veterans, Dr. Guy Stern and Art Holst. Both of them served in the United States Army in Europe, in the European theater during World War II. There have been so many movies, television shows, and books, and novels, and documentaries about World War II over these last seven decades. What do you, as you watch them, what do you think gets missed?
I guess about the war is the single details. And that leads to a movie I just thought about. It's called A Walk in the Sun. And it's about a company taking a farmhouse in Italy. But what goes on in the minds of these soldiers is depicted through their conversations. That detail of how we feel, That is one of the rare things that a movie can do if the directing is good. And the imagination of this director was to have an African-American singer sing a sort of ballad of the undertaking of that platoon.
Yes. I want to switch gears here, thinking about the decades that have passed in America since the war ended in 1945. And here we are in 2018. We have a lot of divisions in our American society, a lot of people who feel left out, they feel left behind, that they didn't get their shot at the American dream. Are we where you thought we would be as a country when you were able to lay down your weapons in 1945?
Yes. I remember frequently, you know, especially when you were in a camp or were in a bivouac, you were woken up and you took your oath of allegiance to the United States. At that time, we said, one nation, indivisible. And I think as the politicians of the past, there was an opposition to the party in power. But when it came here in Michigan, when the war started, Senator Vandenberg, a convinced opponent to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, he wrote a letter to Franklin D. Roosevelt, and he said, accept this letter as an olive branch now that we are in war. And then later on, he wrote another letter to FDR, and he said, Mr. President, partisanship stops at the water's end.
But then the
water's edge.
But here we are. That was a sentiment expressed then. Here we are where partisanship is probably as deep as it's ever been in American history.
Yes, and I consider myself an American patriot, and I think of the moment when this vow of allegiance we took, one nation, indivisible, will become a reality again when the issue is the whole country and all our citizens.
So well-spoken, Guy, absolutely. And when you think about it, as a commander, you have no choice. You can't fire him. You have no choice of who serves with you. You have to take these men and figure out what the strengths are of each guy, because your life depends on him, and his life can depend on you. It may be somebody you would have never associated with, but you need to do it. I cannot understand for the life of me, once an election is passed and we have a president, you can differ on policy, but you can find ways to get together. I used to meet, I'm a Republican, I used to meet with a Democrat who was completely opposite from me. We were great friends and stayed great friends, and we would argue very, very loudly. We met on Friday news. One Friday noon, I said, we're going to meet Friday. I said, let's take one problem and see what we can come up with as a Republican and Democrat. You're in Congress on one side, I'm in Congress on the other. In an hour and a half, we had a bill on Social Security that I would present today. And I said, why can't they do this? Because once we have an election, we are all, as he said, one nation under God.
Art Holst and Guy Stern will be part of the fourth annual Stories of Service. This happens every year to benefit Fisher House, Michigan, and it'll be at Hill Auditorium November 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. You can get all the details by going to fisherhousemichigan.org. Art Holst, Guy Stern, we thank you both for your service, and we thank you for being with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure, and I'm sure his too.
Yes, it was a great interview because of our master of ceremony.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors include Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Natalie Brennan, Joey Horan, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.